Campaign ads are one way to get the message out. Political songs are another. Even America's founding fathers used music to promote their political agenda. Weekend Edition's classical music commentator Robert Greenberg joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to take a closer listen to politics in song. Welcome back to the show.
Always great to be here.
Before we get to hear some of these campaign songs, I'm intrigued by a word you used to describe them. Contra facta. What does that mean?
Isn't that a great word?
It's a great word.
Yeah, a contra facta is a pre-existing and ostensibly a well-known melody that has been fitted out with new words. The advantage of using contra factas for things like campaign songs is that people already know the melodies.
We're going to go way back in history and listen to a John Adams campaign song. It's called Adams and Liberty.
And ne'er shall the sons of Columbia be slaves, while the earth bears a plant and the sea rolls a wave.
I feel like I should be standing with my baseball cap off over my heart. That sounds like the Star Spangled Banner.
It's an English drinking song written in London during the 1760s by someone named John Stafford Smith. But of course, as a melody, it gained much greater fame in 1814 when it was hooked up with words by Francis Scott Key to become, yes, the Star Spangled Banner.
I'll give Oscar Brand some credit for performing it there. Let's talk a little bit about some lyrics. I mean, these songs were not just catchy tunes. I believe in Thomas Jefferson's campaign song, Jefferson and Liberty, there's actually a policy reference?
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson's campaign song refers quite directly to the Alien and Sedition Acts that had been passed by Adams that he, Jefferson, almost immediately repealed. Collectively, these acts are referred to in the song as the Reign of Terror.
The gloomy night before us flies, the reign of terror now is o'er. No gags, inquisitors, and spies.
That's dangerously close to mudslinging there. Do you think, do campaign songs stay polite for the most part?
Oh, of course not. And why should they? By far the most mud that was slung that I could find was a Martin Van Buren campaign song set to Rockabye Baby. It's a song that attacks, I mean brutally attacks, Van Buren's opponents, the Whig Party, and its candidate, William Henry Harrison, who had been the hero of the Battle of Tippecanoe. The words are absolutely hysterical.
Rockabye Baby, Daddy's a Whig. When he comes home, art cider he'll swig. When he has swag, he'll fall in a stew. And down will come Tyler and Tippecanoe.
And I don't think I've ever heard the word swag before.
Or stew, as in stupor, I assume.
Yeah. Wow, that is nasty, huh?
Yeah, and it just keeps getting nastier and nastier. I love it.
The next one we have should sound familiar.
Hello, Linden. Well, hello, Linden. We'd be proud to have you back where you belong.
Oh, my goodness. There's a tune to dance to, huh?
Hello, Dolly opened up on Broadway in January of 64. And, of course, the election, the 64 election, was but months away. So Jerry Herman himself wrote these new words for Hello, Linden, and Carol Channing, the star of the show, herself introduced the song during the 64 campaign.
We're right in the middle of a presidential campaign now, in a trend where candidates tend to pick already existing music and then just play it as is. What do you think about the music in this campaign?
You know, sometimes we do rightly wish for the good old days. It's like a pro wrestling match now. As each wrestler comes out towards the ring, they play whatever their theme song is in the background, but without any personalization. I would hope that someone steps forward and writes just that right sort of song for both of our candidates so that we have something to listen to and talk about in another 15 years.
Music historian Robert Greenberg. He's with San Francisco Performances in the Teaching Company, which markets recorded lectures in the arts and sciences. He joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. As always, Robert, thanks a lot.
My great pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. For my wedding in 1982, I ordered a Carvel ice cream cake. The Carvel brand, famous for its soft serve ice cream, has been around since 1936. The legend is that Tom Carvel's ice cream truck broke down, the product started to melt, but customers liked it soft. So Carvel opened his first store in the same spot where the truck broke down. That store in Hartsdale, New York, closes today. Abdul Faghihi has owned the store for the past 21 years. He's on the phone. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Has anyone ordered a wedding cake recently?
Not recently wedding cake, but we have plenty of cakes that we have been selling.
Birthday cakes, Fudgy the Whale.
Fudgy the Whale, Hug Me the Bear, Cookie Puss.
Oh, Cookie Puss.
Uncle Carvel had so many different cakes.
Why do you have to close?
Basically, we had a lease here for 20 years. And the property was sold to, you know, investors who is putting their own restaurant on it.
Are you getting a lot of customers this weekend?
Recently, I have so many customers coming in. They're expressing their sadness that it's closing, and they're taking pictures of the place. Quite few people bring their kids, and they take pictures. And I had some older couples, believe it or not, like in late 70s, and they told me that they met each other in this store and they wanted to visit it one more time.
Do you have customers there now?
Yes, I do.
Do you think I could talk to one of them or to? Can you pass the phone over?
Sure. Hold on a second. Hello, who's this?
Hi, this is Leanne Hansen at National Public Radio. Who's this?
This is Mike Greco.
What are you buying at Carvel today?
I don't know yet. I'm just taking in the that famous smell that this place has.
Oh, what is it?
Like ice cream.
How long have you been going to the store?
The last time I was here was when I worked at Abraham and Strauss in White Plains back in 1980. Honestly, just forgot about this whole place until I heard that it was going down.
Oh, so you had to go back.
Yeah, we're going back. Came back with my friend Annie, and, you know, we're not even supposed to be eating ice cream. But we got to have the last Carvel, you know?
Yeah. I understand. Thank you. Could I talk to Abdul again?
Sure. Hello?
Hi, Abdul.
Yes.
One last question.
Go on.
What do you think Tom Carvel would have to say about his first store shutting down?
Oh, if he was alive, I am pretty sure that he would have put the money down and keep it. Unfortunately, you know, Tom Carvel had no children, and he left everything for a charity, and they sold the place.
Ah, so...
That's how it worked out.
Abdul Faghihi is the owner of the country's first Carvel ice cream store in Hartsdale, New York. The store closes today. Thank you and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Have a nice day.
This is NPR News.
Now, a duo by the names of Nick and Nora. We're not talking about Nick and Nora Charles of Thin Man fame. There is a new incarnation in the movie Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which opens today. This Nick and Nora are teenagers, and they spend all night searching for a secret concert, and they fall in love along the way. Bob Mondello says the material is familiar, but the movie is smarter than usual.
Nick's a sweet, dweeby high school kid with girlfriend problems. Basically a Michael Cera sort of guy, so it's nice that Michael Cera actually plays him. His girlfriend, Tris, walks all over him. And as you can hear from the phone messages he leaves her, he's having trouble dealing.
You know, I think last time we spoke, we both kind of said some really nasty things that neither of us meant, you know, just like, you broke up with me, you know, everything on my B-day.
Left to his own devices, Nick would just sit at home and mope, but he plays in a band, and tonight there's a secret indie concert he and the band are hoping to find somewhere in New York. A lot of other kids are trying to find it too, including Nora, played by Kat Dennings as a smart, sarcastic Catholic schoolgirl who does not want to appear dateless when she's spotted by what she would call a frenemy.
Nora! Alone again?
I came here with someone, actually.
Who?
My boyfriend.
Your boyfriend? Well, I guess you should be getting back to him then.
Yeah.
Scanning the crowd, Nora spots the least threatening guy, Nick.
Would you be my boyfriend for 5 minutes?
What?
Just go with it.
Which would be great, except the frenemy who recognized her is Tris.
Nick! Nora! How do you guys, like, know each other?
What?
Are you Tris's Nick?
How do you know her?
Oh, dear God.
Having thus met Cute, Nick and Nora will spend the rest of the movie sparring Cute, trading quips and insults, and at one point a punch that leaves Nick temporarily speechless. Happily, things do mellow along the way, which you can tell despite the sparring, because Nick lets Nora check out both his car and his iPod.
This is amazing. You are literally like my musical soulmate.
Maybe I'll take this for a bit and you can just focus on driving.
Why, you don't like my sweet grooves?
It's just, I need something to distract myself from the fact that you're driving my car pretty recklessly right now.
I'm a great driver. Fine.
Though these two really grow on you, what's almost more remarkable than Nick, Nora, or their playlist, which may not be infinite, but which really does include some great music, is the quirky melting pot world that director Peter Sollett creates around them. Vibrant like New York, youthful like the stars, awkward like the characters they're playing, it's unselfconsciously diverse. Nick is the only straight member of his rock band, for instance, a queercore group that in most movies would fade into the background, but that here becomes more and more central. Nora is a Jewish girl in Catholic school, a fact that goes as unremarked as the suburban, urban, and sophisticated doofus character divides. Sex and alcohol figure in the film, but in ways that are gratifyingly unexpected. And gum? Lordy, what happens with gum in this picture you will never, ever forget. Nor, I suspect, will you forget Nick and Nora, who cruise around a New York that seems as romantically supercharged as in any Woody Allen movie, listening to that infinite playlist and falling for each other as audiences will fall for them. I'm Bob Mondello.
The writer Chris Onstad used to work at a Silicon Valley tech firm. He drew cartoon characters in his spare time, which soon became a new career.
The relatively unproven concept of making a living off of a web comic.
A web comic. Your newspaper comic page may be getting smaller, but one source, the webcomiclist.com, counts 12,000 comics online. Chris Onstad's comic strip, Akewood, is among the most acclaimed. That's A-C-H-E, Wood, Akewood. It depicts a stark world in black and white. The characters are coarse, but their inspiration was cuddly.
I sketched out some of my wife's stuffed animals, and I put voices in their mouths. And over time, they actually grew into their own characters.
Well, now, let me just ask about that, though. These are stuffed animals that your wife has had since she was a little girl?
Yeah, and in a couple cases, some of these are 30 years old, sitting on a shelf in our house. Yeah.
Is your wife happy to go online and see that her stuffed animals swear, drink a lot, try to sell obscene products that we won't even describe on the radio, and do various other things?
Yeah, you have to buy the book for that.
In the book, those sweet stuffed animals commit acts of fantastic violence. The book is called The Great Outdoor Fight, which is a made-up extreme sport. Thousands of creatures brawl for days until all but one is torn apart. The story evolved as Chris Onstad posted strips online.
It happened totally by accident. What I do is I'm a cartoonist who works. I post, you know, 3-4 times a week in the mythical world called Akewood that I've made up. And I kind of think of The Great Outdoor Fight as something where, like Tolkien said, the tale grew in the telling. I had a character discover that his long-lost father had won this thing, and then he went to enter it himself. I wrote it day by day, and as a daily gag strip artist, I was really concerned that people weren't going to hang on for the 3 months it took to tell this online. But they did, and it became our most critically acclaimed piece of work ever.
Well, let's go to page 29 of this, if we can. I just wonder if you can describe a couple of your main characters here, because it gets us a little bit into this world that you've created.
On page 29 in the book, what we have is the two major protagonists, Ray, who's sort of the wealthy, chubby, happy-go-lucky, and Roast Beef, who's the depressive roadie who's helping him get to the fight, but he's actually more of a scholar of the thing. Roast Beef is explaining to Ray basically how the Great Outdoor Fight will work once they get inside the grounds. You know, they're talking, they're on the road to Bakersfield, which is where the fight is held every year, and Ray's in the sidecar, being chauffeured to the Great Outdoor Fight, where he's expected to win because he's blood of a former champion. So Ray says, So what's the main thing I got to know going into this? The fight is 3 days, which is enough time for an ad hoc culture to form. Two armies typically arise and their pawns are sent to the front. It's rumored that the army leaders often fight only on days 1 and 3 and traditionally feast on turkeys and brandy on day 2. Damn, sounds like I got to be an army leader. Are there side dishes?
Now, I'm already just looking at the page getting a sense of the different voices that you have assigned to these characters and the way that you've represented that online. Some of these guys are punctuated. Some of them are not so punctuated. Some people use capital letters. Some of them don't. Is there an online reason for that?
There's a grammatical reason. The character who speaks in a smaller typeface without punctuation is the depressive one who I like to imagine speaks in more of a low mumble most of the time. That's just my way of representing that visually. One thing I say time and again is comics are such a restrictive medium. I want to have sound so badly for so much of this stuff.
Well, let me ask about that, because here we are talking on the radio. And those of us who work in the radio know this is a very old, outdated medium. And we persuade ourselves that it's more powerful in a way because the voice is so powerful and you don't have the distraction of an image and you really hear an individual's story. So I want to ask the same question about the comics. Even though it's old, outdated, limited, weak in a way, what is the power of it?
Just like with radio, your brain fills in so many of the blanks. If you look at the art here, it's fairly spare. This is more about the writing, and the richer I can make the dialogue, I think, helps people conjure up in their minds what they want these people to be.
It sounds like people have begun demanding that you fill in more blanks for them. You have blogs written in the voices of many of your characters.
Right. That I did because I was so pent up with, I had so much more I wanted to do with these characters. But even in the format I work in what I consider a sort of a Sunday format every time I post, which is two rows of six or eight panels or more.
Bigger than the tiny daily comic that you'd see in it.
Right. The tiny daily comic, I can't imagine how people work in that medium. It's so small. You can only have like 25 words in one of those or it looks too dense. And I can't get enough done with that. You can't make richness in that. I mean, sure, people argue that, oh, well, Peanuts was rich. That was huge. But yeah, he did that over 50 years.
Yeah.
I'm like at capacity and how much I can produce. But still, I feel like people are always demanding more. So
that raises another question. This is something you hear about comic artists all the time, is the murderous demand of the deadlines.
See, since I work for myself, I regularly blow deadlines left and right like I was going duck hunting. People have great patience for me because typically a responsible man would write his cartoon a few weeks in advance and have it ready, and then it would go live every morning at 8 a.m. on some sort of dependable schedule. But, you know, I'm not doing a little single stripper every morning. I'm creating tales in the making. Sometimes they're really long. Sometimes they're short. Sometimes instead of doing a comic, I'll write a bunch of new blog entries for the characters. And people just have to roll with it. If they disappear, they disappear.
Given that this is a lot of work and that it keeps expanding and you say that it's gotten to the maximum that you can handle at the moment, do you think about famous comic artists like, I don't know, Bill Watterson or Gary Larson, and I should say the authors of Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side, people that did acclaimed work, and one day they said, I'm all through, I'm finished with this, I can't do it anymore, and pretty soon it'd be hard to even say where they were.
Yeah, those guys ran, I don't know, for about 10 years each, right? And they have really great standalone bodies of work. I don't see myself ending the Akewood daily strip just yet, but I really do want to branch out into other things. I don't just want to be a daily strip guy. And I think those guys like Watterson and Larson, they might look like, you know, silly little comics, but those guys put their heart and soul into those things, and they stopped because they had to, because I don't want to say they're well dried up, but you don't feel the same way forever. I like the characters in this body of work. I like the voices. I think they cover all aspects of the way I see the world. Not all aspects. But I've created a good vehicle for communicating with people. And I don't want to throw it away.
Chris Onstad is the creator of the online comic strip Akewood and author of The Great Outdoor Fight. Great talking with you.
All right, man.
You can read an excerpt from The Great Outdoor Fight at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.